This is Icon Art Radio with Donna Colby, Alan Cobb, and me, Bill Teeple, broadcasting from the Cultural District on the Fairfield Square in Fairfield, Iowa, broadcasting from Icon Gallery. And here we are. Okay, Donna, you have been walking around doing things without your glasses. What is that all about?
Well, I'm doing an experiment about what our priorities really have been all our lives in the visual experience and what the other possibilities might be. I started wearing glasses at the age of 13 because of nearsightedness. And all of us, I think, who've worn glasses for much of our lives have gotten used to the idea that good vision means everything is really clear and the edges are nice and sharp. And so I've been working a lot in my studio with doing a lot of painting lately, and this experiment of not wearing my glasses has to do with being more open-minded about the priorities and not necessarily thinking that seeing everything completely clearly and in focus is the best way to see. It made me realize that in many fine art photographs, in some fine art photographs, everything is purposely out of focus. Often something is very clearly in focus and the background is all out of focus. And so there are a lot of possibilities of beautiful ways of seeing. And what I've noticed a few things since I've been doing this. One is that if I go for a walk, for example, in the morning, a long walk without my glasses on, I notice that my other senses are more alive. The vision is not as dominant, so I hear more, I feel more of the air on my skin, of the temperature of the day and all. And the other thing that I notice is that the lighting conditions make a tremendous difference in how I'm seeing. And I'll walk from a bright sunny day into my living room, and in the bright sunny day, the edges are sharper and everything is clear, and I walk into my living room and it's more like grainy feel, which has its own beauty,
sure.
Actually.
Yeah.
And I've also been enjoying just having the air on my bare eyes instead of having a piece of plastic in front of my eyes all the time. So it's a very interesting experiment. And we were talking just before we started recording, Alan was mentioning that a lot of our visual perception is done in our brain through brain processing and not through the mechanical apparatus of our eyes. And so let's talk about that a little bit more too. You've got more knowledge
well,
than I do.
You know, let me go back to something we actually haven't mentioned for a while, and that's how some of the great masters of oil painting actually achieved the visual effects that they were painting. And I'm thinking specifically of Rembrandt, because he's known for these kind of subdued light images with, you know, very rich tones and very subtle shades. And it strikes me that part of his skill comes from his ability to turn off some of the processing that we're accustomed to. Even a beginning artist, a visual artist, you know, you learn to look through a grid, or you learn to look through a perspective thing, or you draw the lines of perspective on a piece of glass and see in two dimensions what you know is in three dimensions. Well, of course, actually, you don't see it in three dimensions. You don't see it in two dimensions either. You see it projected on the interior surface of a sphere. And the spherical distortion of the image that is projected on the back of your eyeball, which is what you physically see in a sense, is pronounced. I mean, if you take any kind of image and project it on a sphere, it's ridiculously distorted. And yet, that achieves something mechanically that's advantageous for the eye. It means that every point on the retina is about the same distance from the lens, so it has the same focal distance. Normally, you have a plane of focus from a lens, and if you project a planar lens onto a curved surface, so you get almost nothing in focus. But there's so much processing going on that we just simply know that it's 3D out there. And it is 3D, I guess, if you believe that there is a volumetric universe that we're, you know, rummaging around in. And yet, when you move your head around and look at the room from different perspectives, you also see the walls and the floor and the ceiling remaining constant. But if you do that with a camera, if you wave a camera around and take a bunch of pictures from different angles, just still sitting in the chair in the same place, and look at those pictures, they're all different. The walls are doing terrible things. They're bulging forward and shrinking away and getting foreshortened and less foreshortened. And the geometric distortion that's taking place as you move your eye around is drastic. And yet, we don't see that at all. We see this continuous image, which is absolutely stable, and the color schemes stay the same, even though some of it's lit with incandescent light, and some of it's lit with daylight, and some of it's lit with fluorescent light or halogen. It's only when you look at it through a camera, which doesn't know that it's white in all of those different light sources, that you begin to see that those lights are all different colors. And the daylight down there is blue, and the incandescent light in here is orange, and the you know, halogen light is a little less orange. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there are so many different massive sections of neurology that are devoted, in the physiology, that are devoted entirely to processing the image that, I think one of the things you mentioned earlier about seeing things more clearly sometimes, even though you're not wearing your glasses, it's as if the lenses that don't focus perfectly are suddenly focusing perfectly, and yet we can be pretty confident that physically that's not actually happening. So then the question is, how could it look clear? And to me, the answer is inevitably that the brain can make it clear, and does.
So why wouldn't it? Like, because the first time that happened to me, it was in, I was in Switzerland in the 1970s, and I woke up one morning, and I had perfect vision without my glasses or contacts I wore back then. Without my contacts, I had perfect clear vision. And it lasted for 4 days. And I was absolutely positive that a miracle had taken place and my sight was now going to be perfect. And then on the fifth day when I woke up, it was back to the usual nearsighted. And I was crushed, absolutely crushed. So if it was, like you said, something going on in my brain that allowed that shift to take place and I was perceiving clearly, why would it stop? Why would my brain not realize that I was absolutely ecstatic over this? And
well, wouldn't it be
wanted
nice
to please
if
you?
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if it wanted to please us?
I mean, it's my brain after all.
Yeah,
so
really.
Answer that, Alan.
Well, there are a lot of different motivations that this brain is responding to, none of which are yours. It's in a world of biological and, you know,
so it's just
biochemical
random
imperatives. No, not at all random. But, it's like hearing when a very young infant hears musical tones. Recent research shows that most very young children have absolute pitch, and they're able to remember a specific note in terms of pitch with the same interest and familiarity that we recognize colors. And I'm not talking about synesthesia, where you actually see a color when you hear a note, but in this case, it's you feel a certain quality of that note. And people who have absolute pitch always tend to describe it that way. They'll say, well, E flat has a different feeling from E natural. It's obvious. And you say, well, it's not at all obvious to me. It seems like it's just slightly lower pitched. And they say, no, but it's got this quality to it that's more pulling or pushing or something. And you think, gosh, what are they talking about? Well, people in countries that use highly inflected languages, like Chinese, where inflection conveys a tremendous proportion of the meaning, not just the pronunciation, have a much higher incidence of absolute pitch in their culture. And it's been suggested, and there's a wonderful discussion of all this in the book Musicophilia by Oliver Sacks, who wrote The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and several other wonderful
famous
neurology books. It's a non-technical book. I mean, his approach to neurology is studying people and their experiences, not getting bogged down in biochemistry, although he knows all of that stuff too. And he writes technical books in addition. But anyway, the experience of a tonal quality, of a particular pitch rather, having a quality of its own is something that the vast majority of Westerners don't have. We don't know what they're talking about. We can sort of imagine it, but we don't get it. And not all great musicians have it, but many do. And as it turns out, if there's a great deal of musical training at a very early age, it seems to people with that experience seem to be much more likely to retain absolute pitch. So the theory now is that we all kind of start with absolute pitch, or many of us, if not most of us, do. And because our linguistic requirements teach the neurology to pay more attention to relative pitch, so I can ask a question by ending with a lilt at the end, that change in pitch that makes it a question is more important than whether I'm speaking at this note or whether I'm speaking it at this note. There's no change in meaning when I change the pitch of what I'm saying. Whereas in Chinese, there might be. And if you do it within certain words, there's a much more of an absolute pitch requirement. So I guess what I'm getting at is that when you translate that kind of thing into vision, there are whole specialized centers of the brain that are just for pitch recognition. And then there are others that are just for timbral recognition. And then there are others that are just for interval recognition, distinguishing the differences between two consecutive pitches. And then there are still others that are attuned to the harmonic relationship of simultaneous pitches. And then, of course, there's another whole section that deals in the short-term time delays between the signals coming in one ear and the other that tell you about what kind of space you're in and where the sound is positioned. And vision has a comparable set of specialized kind of interpretive functions and facilities involving huge amounts of gray matter. So it's not hard for me to imagine that there is a function that deals with the edges, the edge detection in the visual image. And that is mitigated by knowledge. In fact, hearing is a two-way street. Our sense of frequency, of pitch itself, is modulated by the brain being reconnected to cilia in the cochlea. You know, it's the cilia, these little hair cells that get vibrated at different frequencies, and which cilium gets vibrated tells you kind of whether it's high-pitched or low-pitched. But there are other ciliums that don't send a signal to the brain at all. They get a signal from the brain and influence how the other cilia respond. So the brain can prejudice the detector in your ear to be more sensitive to certain frequencies than others dynamically throughout the day. So I think the brain can do the same thing visually. And whether it's inclined to do so or not is, you know, another question. But there's no question in my mind that anything we can do with digital image processing, and probably a whole lot more, can be done by the brain's image processing, which I think makes digital image processing look pathetic and vaguely irrelevant.
So you may not be able to answer this, but in the case of my experience I was describing before, where I had perfect vision for 4 days and then it went away, and you said something was going on in those parts of my brain that allowed that to happen. So what kind of reasons would the brain have? I mean, would it be just that there was some external or internal set of conditions going on at that time that awakened that portion of my brain, but those conditions were not able to sustain it long-term?
I think it has more to do with where we put our attention. And the attention at a very, very subtle level could go onto the actual geometric shapes that are coming in through the lens onto the back of the retina. Or it could be, the attention could be on the meaning of what's coming in, and we're seeing walls which we know are vertical. And once we know they're vertical, they aren't going to look anything but vertical. So once you know that everything is blurry, it's going to have to be blurry or it contradicts your reality. And yet at a finer, at a subtler level, you know everything is not blurry, because the definition of vision is vague in its own right. Or when we're talking about vision, we're not really talking about the projected image on the retina. We're talking about the personal experience of vision and how many, you know, I don't know how many dozens of people I've spoken to who have experienced seeing the room that they're meditating in while their eyes are closed. That certainly has happened to me many times. And I see the room sometimes clearly enough so that, although I can't objectively prove it, I'm completely convinced that if someone had walked into the room, I would have seen them walking into the room. It felt like I was seeing the room without needing to have my eyelids get out of the way. Now, maybe there's no physiological explanation for it, and that's purely, you know, mystical and speculative, but in any case, we know that the sense of vision can operate without eyeballs, probably can't operate without a visual cortex. I don't know. That's asking for you to remove most of your brain. But it means that at some level of the process of vision, you know, things are very different. You don't need to have your eyes open to see things in memory. You could look at something and that could be enough to tell the brain what it is that you're looking at. And then you could, from that moment until things change a little, be looking at a perfect memory of that thing that you already know
about.
Well,
that's what Picasso could do. Picasso mm-hmm. never worked from a model. Mm-hmm. He would look at what he wanted to paint, and then he would go back in his studio and with perfect visual memory mm-hmm. paint it as if it were right there in yeah. front of him. And I mean, even like portraits of people yeah. that he'd barely met.
Yeah.
That's great.
And it goes even beyond that, because you look at an apple and somewhere, you know, in your associative memory system, you have the sum of all apples. You know, you have the archetype of apple, and you can see that too, depending mm-hmm. again on where your attention goes. So it could be that a person could acquire the inclination to or skill to look at any apple and always see the ultimate apple yeah. hidden in the actual apple.
Well, and artists use this all the time. They hint yeah. in the direction of something visually, and then the visual mechanism of the viewer fills it all
sure.
in.
Yeah.
So you have to be careful
right.
that you don't tick off the wrong thing. As,
yeah.
as an artist, if you want to convey an apple, you might be looking at an apple that has shading such that it looks almost like a peach even. Mm-hmm. So you have to make sure you shade it towards the universal apple so that you
yeah.
convey to the
yeah.
viewer that you're talking about apple.
Well, or you can go take it too far, though, like little children do in when they reach a certain age in school where first they're like really spontaneous in their art, and then all of a sudden everybody's trees look exactly alike and everybody's houses exactly alike and their flowers. Mm-hmm.
But that's a little different too, because somebody's taught them how to do a tree.
Yeah.
You do like this and you put a trunk on it. And,
yeah.
But now I want to say something here, even though we've gone off into this whole thing of vision, but it's interesting. Because I studied a book for a while and I practice exercises to improve my vision naturally. Since I've been here in the last decade, I've fell off the wagon of many practices of that sort and have become a decadent art man, wearing with 20/20. I now wear 20/20 vision, which I never did in my life. One of the reasons being so that I can see art. One of the reasons I did that is so I could see the art on the wall and my students' art as they see it. To be a teacher, I did it on purpose. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit of a weird thing because I realized that my brain had to adapt to this clear vision because I had always had less than perfectly 20/20 lenses because I was trying to have my brain kind of fill in and not get dependent. Mm-hmm. But this book that I read talked about the psychology of this whole thing, that much of the way that we see and the places we repair to visually, like towards farsightedness and nearsightedness, had to do with early childhood psychology. More, this was his whole thing, more than just some mechanical situation. So he worked on the side of psychology along with mechanical visual exercises for the eye. Because he was saying like that nearsighted people sort of retreat into a place away from the outer world. So they want it to get fuzzy. They don't want it to be clear.
Oh, in other words, when you were a little child, there was some part of you that didn't actually want to see what was in the distance.
No, that's his kind of premise.
Yeah,
he worked with him.
Well, it could work the
results.
Other way too. Oh, yeah. You know, you could as things get blurry, you kind of tune them out because you can't discern the details of what's going on around you.
Well, because there's another thing I noticed, like in this last week, not wearing my glasses very much, I realized that there's a certain laziness that I had fallen into by wearing my glasses all the time and having everything in my range of vision clearly all the time, is that I didn't have any reason to go really up closely and look at something. And there was a rose that I could see out my back door was fully bloomed in my garden. And in order to see it, instead of looking at it from my doorway with my glasses on, if I didn't have my glasses on, I had to actually go out and look at it close up. And when I did, I noticed that it was spectacular and had all of these amazing subtle relationship to the sun and the shadow, and it had dewdrops on it. And if I had just seen it from a little distance away with my glasses on, I wouldn't have noticed those details. But it was a marvelous thing to study it.
Which also suggests, this brings up the idea that we're not all supposed to see the same. Mm-hmm. That there's as many kinds of seeing as there are kinds of people.
Yeah.
And that some people live in a certain kind of visual world and live in a different visual world. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But because we drive on freeways and all of this and read signs and have to miss the pedestrians and stuff, we've all use these mechanical devices to all see the same, or we're forced to.
Well, and also the psychology of sight is profoundly powerful. There are demonstrations where you look at a video of people doing something, and it's a 5-minute video or 2-minute video, and you see the whole thing, and your challenge is to report anything really unusual that you notice in the video. And at the end of the video, 95% of the people who watch it report, didn't see anything unusual at all. And then they play the video a second time and they say, look for the guy with the basketball. And then they notice that there's a guy in a clown suit bouncing a bright orange basketball across the back of the scene. And everyone missed it. And it's all just in a, 4x8 piece of screen in front of them. You know, there's absolutely no reason they could have missed it, except that they were expecting certain visual experiences based on what's going on in the foreground. You know, the magician, I think it was Howard Thurston, one of the great old stage magicians once said that, you know, he could, or maybe it was, this might be attributed to Houdini, but anyway, he said that he could make anything disappear in front of an audience. And he proceeded to bring out a goat, and he stood on one side of the stage with the goat, and then a scantily clad woman came out on the other side of the stage and did a little something, and the goat disappeared. And everyone was amazed, except that all the magician had done was when she came out, he picked the goat up in his arms, turned around, carried it off stage, walked back onto the stage without it, and no one saw him. And they also all saw that he had not moved, even though, of course, he had. So there's an awful lot of projection going on in what we see. We're filling in the gaps all the time. And I think if we could literally play with the signal processing equipment, the image processing facilities of the mind and the brain, while looking at the image, you know, with the complete freedom to look at it at whatever level we want and activate whatever capacities of the brain we want, it would be quite astonishing what we could see and do with vision.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.